334-692-5739 and call soon or go to volunteer@AveMariaRadio.net.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is Dana Gioia. He's a nationally known poet, writer, essayist, critic, and was for 6 years the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, appointed by President George W. Bush. And we're going to talk a little about that later because he enacted some very, very effective and very creative programs during his tenure there. But for the first 15 years of his career, he worked for General Foods. And it wasn't until 1991 when his essay in The Atlantic entitled Can Poetry Matter that he was able to leave General Foods behind and take up writing full time. Dana Gioia, welcome back to Church and Culture.
I'm glad to be back.
Now, you have a volume of poetry forthcoming. It's on the way. It's entitled 99 Poems Selected Anew. Can you tell us a little about what we can expect from that?
Well, you know, this is for me the big book in a way because it represents my entire career as a poet. And what I've tried to do is to take 99 poems from all of the poems, translations, even libretto, you know, sort of opera
right.
songs.
You have two opera libretti that you've composed.
Yeah, and represent the best of my work.
It's your summa.
Yeah, well, it is. This is kind of the moment to which a poet works, which is to say, you know, this is the best of what I have accomplished, and, you know, what do you think? So it was rather, you know, difficult to put it together, you know, because it puts you into all kinds of neurotic self-examination.
you had to decide what to leave out.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm arranging it differently than the way most poets do, you know, because they're trying to do chronological, counter-chronological, this, that, and the other. And that's interesting, but I thought I would arrange my book into seven sort of little thematic sections. Because I think when readers read a book of poems, they're not primarily interested in the chronology of an author's life. You know, unless there's some huge story, you know, that's reflected.
Right.
So mine are described as mystery, imagination, remembrance, place, story, song, and love. And, you know, and so I don't think anybody's ever organized a book that way, but I, you know, it seemed to me that my work sort of fell into that. And, you know, I think it's just a better way for readers to come into work. You know, but you know, basically what I've done is tried to write poems as good as I possibly can and as truthfully as I possibly can. And, you know, this is, in a sense, the moment of truth. You know, my books have done well. They've sold well. You know, but, you know, the question is, what have I been up to as a poet? And I hope the book will answer it.
I'm talking with Dana Gioia, poet, writer, critic. Now, are there new poems in this volume
yes,
as well?
Yes, there's, I think, about 15 new poems. Every section has at least, you know, one new poem, but, you know, most of them have more. And, you know, being a poet and even hearing a poet talk about things is usually probably dull for a non-poet. But my sense, reading a lot of people's work, is that they tend to write the same poem over and over and over. And perhaps that's inevitable because, you know, you sort of have your life. But I've tried very hard to make my poems different from one another. And one of the ways that I do it is simply by having different forms, having them sound different. You know, I'm infamous among contemporary poets for reviving rhyme, meter.
You're called a formalist.
Yeah, a new formalist was the name they gave us. And, you know, once again, I think that, you know, what you try to do is to make this the poem interesting, engaging. In fact, the word I've been using is enchanting. And I've just finished writing a long essay called Poetry as Enchantment.
Wow.
And, you know, poetry, is the most ancient human art. This goes back as far as we can go back to in history, and actually before written history. And poetry comes out of ritual, worship, song, and there's an element that you're trying to make the reader, in the process of listening to the poem, slightly hypnotized.
Yeah, Homer performed his epics, didn't he? I mean, he sung them to an audience.
All ancient poetry is sung or chanted. I mean, you just even think of the Psalms. You know, they were, performed musically. And so poetry and song were the same art in the ancient world. And that should tell you something about the nature of poetry. A poem needs to behave like a song. Now, nowadays, you know, we don't use the music, you know, unless, like me, you collaborate with musicians. But the root of it is to create a kind of musical performance, a kind of listening that the reader hears and is enchanted, in the sense that that low level of enchantment makes you pay more attention, it drops your defenses, and it allows your own imagination, your memories, your deepest self to come to the surface.
It becomes more of an encounter than just reading a text.
Yeah, and exactly. And if all you do is read a text and you're here and the text is on the page, that act of enchantment hasn't happened, because the reader is a necessary collaborator to the poet. So, now this is not a popular theory nowadays, but I'm absolutely sure this is how Dante thought of poetry, how Shakespeare thought of poetry, how William Blake thought of poetry, you know, how even, you know, Robert Frost or T.S. Eliot thought of poetry.
Now, this is, I think, accounts for one reason for this explosion in the audiobook world. I mean, more and more people are listening to particularly fiction in recorded form than they are reading it. And I think what you just said about poetry is true for other written works of imagination. You agree?
Yeah, well, if you look at the history of the art, I mean, poetry is an art that not only appears, but it's developed and perfected before writing as a technology is invented. So there's something about the way we hear stories, the way we hear songs, you know, that is very germane to the literary experience. I mean, Dickens, in some ways, you know, wrote his novels so they could either be read on the page or read aloud. And a lot of people would read them aloud to the family. And the audiobook recaptures this. You know, there's a Father Walter Ong.
Oh, yeah, very famous.
You know, very famous.
Jesuit at the University of Toronto.
Yeah. You know, he was obsessed and wrote brilliantly about orality in literature, about, you know, the way that hearing operates in literature. You know, he eventually relates it, you know, to sacramental experience.
Yes.
But, he had a very simple thing that he observed, which is that if I see a book, it is outside me physically. But if I hear a poem, if I hear a song, If I hear a story, I experience it inside myself. And there's something fundamentally different about these experiences that we have that are inner than the ones that we can, you know, safely keep outside ourselves.
It's the idea of sound penetrating more deeply into the soul.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's sort of Schopenhauer's point about why music is the greatest of the arts.
Yeah, because it's invisible.
Right.
Curiously, is one of the things he says. But that's the way I feel as a poet. I write my poems to be heard. And
you know, from the moment I met you, 20 years ago, one thing I noticed immediately is how beautifully you read not just your poem, but any poems. And, you know, I've always wanted to ask you, is this something you've actually worked on, is your reading of poems? Is this something that you've rehearsed over the years, or did it come naturally to you?
Well, I have rehearsed it in the sense that I've always read poems aloud. I've always read poems aloud to other people. I've memorized poems. And so by the time I got to be my 40s, to me the experience of a poem was to, to memorize, it, and then say it to myself. And as you do that, you perfect it. And
right.
Suddenly, once I quit my business job, I found myself working for BBC Radio. And they would give, were having me read poems on radio all the time.
If you can read a poem on BBC, then you've really accomplished something.
Well, it's, and so you.
Did they accept the American accent?
Well, they had to. I mean, I think I was lucky, they had all these beautiful Oxonian accents, and I was the exotic.
You were the mid-American guy.
But once again, on radio, that works really nicely because it helps you identify the voices. And so, but anyway, so I've learned by doing it. I've written, and nowadays, it sounds odd, but when I write, a lot of times I just walk around talking to myself.
Yes.
And I try to physically write these poems. I remember there's a poem of mine called it "Angel with the Broken Wing." It's a very Catholic.
Do you remember it? Do you have it memorized?
I can probably do it from memory.
Go ahead, "Angel with the Broken Wing" by Dana Gioia.
Yeah, this is spoken by a Mexican statue of an angel that's in a museum, and it's been damaged, and the museum has it sort of enclosed, and it was once in a sort of small church. And the poem is really about the difference between a piece of art that's used for worship rather than one that's just used for aesthetic contemplation. The angel with the broken wing. I am the angel with the broken wing, the one large statue in this quiet room. The staff find me too fierce, and so they shut faith's ardor in this air-conditioned tomb. The docents praise my elegant design above the chatter of the gallery. Perhaps I am a masterpiece of sorts, the perfect emblem of futility. Mendoza carved me for a country church. His name's forgotten now, except by me. I stood beside a gilded altar where the hopeless offered God their misery. I heard their women whispering at my feet, prayers for the lost, the dying, and the dead. Their candles stretched my shadow up the wall, and I became the hungers that they fed. I lost my left wing in the revolution. Even a saint can savor irony. When troops were sent to vandalize the chapel, they hit me once, almost apologetically. For even the godless feel something in a church, a twinge of hope, fear, who knows what it is, a trembling unaccounted by their laws, an ancient hunger that they can't dismiss. There is so much I must tell God. The howling of the damned can't reach so high, but I stand here like a dead thing nailed to a perch, a crippled saint against a painted sky.
That was Angel with a Broken Wing, a poem read by its author, Dana Gioia. And Dana, would it bother you if I said it reminded me of Philip Larkin's Church Going?
Well, I would be complimented because Philip Larkin is one of the greatest poets of the 20th century.
But it's better than Church Going. It probes more deeply into this very thing Larkin was going after.
Well, it has a different perspective and fidelity,
perspective of belief.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, Larkin goes into a church and feels the sanctity of the church, but he says it's all fraud, and you know, and he's an atheist, and isn't it sad that there's nothing up there? And you know, and I'm you know saying just the opposite. There is something up there, and that even the godless feel it in church. And so, I mean,
which is true, by the way. I mean, you hear people all the time saying, "Well, I was in Europe and I went into this cathedral and that cathedral, and it felt sacred." And of course, there are people who end up becoming Catholics or Christians because of the experience of walking into sacred space like that.
Well, that's the central importance of art that so many Catholics and so many Catholic clergy have forgotten. You know, there are many ways to come to God. And we are, you know, we have bodies as well as souls, and art, architecture, painting, sculpture, music, even poetry, is a way that people hear the divine, see the divine, experience the divine in this world. And when the church gives that up, the church, in some ways, has lost one of the most powerful ways of calling people to God.
Well, in one sense, it's lost it because it doesn't produce that much anymore, that kind of art. But fortunately for us, the art of the former epochs of the church is still there. The cathedrals are there, the paintings are there, the poetry is there, the music is there. And it doesn't get much appreciation from the contemporary church, or doesn't get performed much in the contemporary church, but when it does, it reminds you of how worship can be, and I'll use this phrase reluctantly, supercharged by a Palestrina Mass or the Allegri Miserere, for example.
Well, it comes down to the experience of beauty, which people do not understand very well nowadays. In fact, even academics and intellectuals don't understand very well. But it is a universal human experience, and we've all had it, where we're in the presence of something which speaks to us so powerfully that we feel that there's a deep transaction going on. And you know, I think that the experience of beauty falls into four stages. The first is that, you know, all of us are busy, we're rushing around, but something suddenly arrests our attention. You know, it can be natural, it can be a work of art, and it makes us stop for a moment, to contemplate it, to see it. So the first, thing is to stop, to momentarily pause. And the second part of the experience is this extraordinary rush of the deepest sort of pleasure. And, you know, it is so beautiful. The pleasure is so strong that we've stopped there and we are basking in it. We want to go nowhere else for the moment. And then the third stage is something that's rather odd that happens. And I'll give you an example. I was up in the San Juan Islands in Washington State a few days ago, and I was with the composer Morten Lauritsen, and we're driving along this road, and we see some people stopping at this bluff on the beach, and Lauritsen says, I think I know why they're stopping. So we pull over there, and we're standing on this cliff, And they're not all that far from us. There's a great pod of orcas, you know, killer whales. And they're leaping out of the water, you know, and you know, and they're black and white, so they're very striking creatures, and they're huge, and they're leaping out of the water, and you watch it, and you start to see them, and then suddenly you leaps out, and you see a mother with a calf, you know, jumping together, and it's beautiful, and it's arresting, and then the third part of the beauty experience happens, which is suddenly you realize this beautiful thing that has arrested your attention is bringing you into the truths of existence, and these orcas are there, and the reason they're there is that the Chinook salmon are running, and these orcas have come, you know, they've gathered together their whole tribe, you know, young and old, and they're you know, feasting, you know, on all of the salmon, and you see something about, you know, in this case, how the natural cycle works. It's not part of your life. In some ways, it's, you know, it's a terrifying thing of, you know, killer whales devouring salmon, but it is beautiful because it is true, because this is the way that the world works. This is the order that God has put into the world. And in the presence of this truth, you know, you are, in a sense, you momentarily understand something about yourself and the order of the world. And then the fourth thing about the, you know, experience of beauty is that it vanishes in a way. You cannot possess this.
Right.
You know, it is, you know, it is outside
it's
of you.
It's transitory.
Yeah, and that connection between beauty, pleasure, truth, and, you know, objectivity, in a sense, as it vanishes. You know, I mean, you know, Thomas Aquinas once defined humility as seeing things as they really are. By seeing things as they really are, in the sense of beauty, it does make us humble before the wonders of creation. And when, you know, when art loses a deep and true understanding of the nature of beauty, it just becomes decor.
Yes.
You know, I think a lot of paintings are, you know, people buy them because they're fashionable, and they're mostly yellow, and that will go with the decor in their living room. You know, and so I'm, as a poet, in my humble way, I am trying in my poems to get at the heart of things. You know, I think Jacques Maritain.
Yeah, recreate creation.
Yeah, the phrase I was thinking from Maritain, that great, you know, modern thinker, was that the secrets of existence radiating into the intelligence.
Yes. Well, that's what you just described in your description of from the vision to the deep pleasure to the sense of seeing the truth or being confronted with the truth to self-consciously thinking about the natural order. You describe Maritain's own description of the aesthetic experience and the unity of the transcendentals that's involved in that experience.
And, you know, there's this contemporary theory, you know, universally taught in universities, which is that, well, you know, beauty is this mechanism that one group uses to put their power over on another group, and it's, you know, beauty is a kind of mechanism of lies, you know, blah, 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 blah. But that isn't, you know, that aggrandizes you, you know, but that isn't true. If I go to the Grand Canyon, and I stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, and I see this magnificent, immeasurable phenomenon there, it doesn't aggrandize me. It reminds me how small I am, how small humanity is versus the splendors of creation. And, you know, so it's, I mean, I think it's, you know, possibly because I'm a Catholic, but also I think simply as a commonsensical person, I cannot accept, you know, these postmodern theories of beauty because they're not true to my experience.
No.
And, you know, and so I think there's a very powerful transaction that happens when, you know, about a month ago I was in Italy to attend a conference on faith and literature in Rome. And I took the opportunity to go to the town of Orvieto.
Love that town.
Which I'd never been to before.
Mm-hmm.
Which has this great, you know, walled city on a hill.
Yes.
And in the middle of it is the great cathedral.
Yes.
And
that beautiful, I remember the beautiful stonework in that cathedral.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's, you for the moment you walk into that cathedral, you are in a different realm of existence. And it is so powerful. And then off to one side is Luca Signorelli's chapter, you know, sort of chapel, which, you know, which influenced Michelangelo for the Sistine Chapel, in which he describes the end of the world. And, you know, you go there, and it's this, you know, for anybody, it's a powerful experience. But for a Catholic, you know, you're in this sacred space, this kind of sacred instruction is going on simply through the paintings, the architecture, the statues, and we haven't even begun about music, because I can only imagine what this place would sound like filled with a Mozart mass.
I'm talking with Dana Gioia, a poet, essayist, a critic, a man of the arts and the humanities. He was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts for 6 years under President Bush. But after the next brief message, we're going to listen to a piece of music by the composer he already mentioned, Morten Lauritzen, that is a setting of a poem by Dana Gioia entitled Prayer. And I listened to it for the first time this morning, and it's a masterpiece, an absolute masterpiece of choral music. So we'll be back to listen to that piece and listen to Dana's comments on the piece and the origin of it, the words that were said by Lauritzen, just after this message.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
What are the 10 worst things you can say to your kids? Well, according to an article that ran in the popular magazines a few years back, I looked at these 10 worst things. And I don't know about you, but on any given day, I can hit 3 or 4 of them. You give me a week, I'll run the whole list. They were things like this. Do it or else. Because I said so. Please just shut up. You don't come now, I'm leaving without you. Now, I suppose we could make a case that those aren't the coolest things to say to kids, but the 10 worst. This is a classic example of what we are doing to parents. We are taking human characteristics, part of our fallen nature, and we are elevating them to the highest summits of psychological evil. We take things that we all say to our children in maybe not our better moments as parents, and we go, those are the 10 worst things you can say to your children. All manner of psychological trauma and buried deep psychic issues to be dredged up at later points in life. Why? Because you were a human, that's why. You were a parent. One mother said to me one time, you know, I read this stuff, and I come away feeling like the worst thing for a child is a parent. I believe that the 10 worst things that we can say to our children, most of us would never, ever say. I'm Dr. Ray.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
I'm back with Dana Gioia, nationally known poet, writer, critic, man of the humanities and the arts. You know, Dana, a few days ago you sent me a YouTube video of a new choral composition by Morten Lauritzen, the man you watched the Orca Whales with. And of course, Morten Lauritzen is one of the handful of greatest living composers and perhaps the greatest choral composer we have right now. But he set a poem of yours entitled Prayer, and I want to ask you just flat out, how do you feel about your words being set to what is undoubtedly a masterpiece of choral composition?
I feel vastly honored. I mean, he took my words and he essentially took them to an entirely new level of expressivity.
Did you expect something? I mean, when you heard that your poem had been set, were you prepared for something just as beautiful as his previous masterwork, O Magnum Mysterium?
Well, you know, you never know what to expect, but, I mean, it was from the moment I heard the first piano notes, I knew that it was going to be something wonderful. And, you know, the first version was a song, just a song for piano and voice. And then he took those ideas and he made the piece longer and richer as a choral piece. You know, so it's different and, but even more, you know, sort of magnificently beautiful. And then, you know, then he even did the duet version later. So he loves to play with the ideas, but the choral version, I mean, is just transcendently beautiful.
I want our listeners to know, if they don't, that Morten Lauritsen is, 73 years old now?
Yeah.
And he, tell us a little about him. I want our, before we play a minute of the piece, the last 60 seconds of the piece, I want our listeners to know who Morten Lauritsen is and how important he is to the history of classical music, but particularly of sacred music.
Well, you know, Lauritsen, is a Westerner. He was, born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, but he spent almost all of his career, teaching at USC in Los Angeles.
This is where you teach.
Yeah, well, it's where I now teach. But what he does is that every summer, actually even the longer if he has more time, he goes up to this island, this, you know, very remote island in the San Juan Islands of Washington State, on Waldron Island, and in this the quiet of a place that has, you know, no electricity, no stores, I mean, really nothing but nature, in this kind of ramshackle old building, you know, overlooking the bay, on a broken piano, he's composed some of the most beautiful music, you know, in our lifetime. His motet, O Magnum Mysterium, is probably the most widely performed, piece of sacred music by any living composer.
And that is an amazing feat in itself.
It is. I mean, when you hear his music, it's modern, but it's modern in a way which recapitulates even the entire history of Western sacred music.
He's remained in the tradition, but he's not been bound and shackled by it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and it's, there's a, actually, there's a film that was done by him called A Shining Night by Michael Stillwater, you know, which is trying to get at, when people hear Lauritsen's music, they are transformed. I mean, and what drew me to his music is the fact that it affects me in some ways more deeply than almost any other living composer. The only other living composer who just goes to this part of my, you know, this is sacred music I'm talking about, because you know, there's a lot of pop music and things like that that's wonderful, but is Arvo Pärt.
Yes.
Arvo Pärt and Morten Lauritsen have this ability to bring me into an experience of the divine.
Well, let's listen to it. Last minute of Prayer, based upon a poem by Dana Gioia, set to music by Morten Lauritsen. It's being performed with the composer at the piano and the, I believe it's the Wartburg College Choir. Let's listen to it.
Watch.
that was the last 30 or 40 seconds of Morton Lawrenson's choral composition, Prayer, set to a poem by Dana Gioia. Dana, what words were they singing there at the very end of that piece?
This is a poem that I wrote in memory of my first son who died as an infant.
Michael.
Yeah, died at 4 months of sudden infant death syndrome. And it's a prayer for him. And it's the very end is, you know, watch over him as a mountain guards its covert oar and the harsh falcon its flightless young. You know, so it's a prayer for my dead son.
Wow. But when did you write that?
Back in the very end of the 80s. You know, my son died a few days before Christmas in 1987. So, you know, it was written. I didn't write anything for a little, you know, while, you know, for months after he died. But once
Dana, I don't know if you're aware of this, and I'm almost hesitant to bring it up on air, but are you familiar with the great choral piece, Hymnus Paradisi, that was written by Herbert Howells?
Yes, because Howells also had a son named Michael.
For the death of his son named Michael.
Yeah, who died, I think, at 9 or something like that.
Yes, also named Michael. And that's a unknown masterpiece, a relatively unknown masterpiece that deserves much wider hearing. I think it's on a par with any piece of 20th century sacred music.
It's a beautiful, beautiful piece.
And it's the most beautiful setting of a psalm I've ever heard. And but I think this piece that we just heard, the very end of, is going to be viewed as and recognized as a masterpiece going forward. How did you first hear about it? Is this a poem you sent to Lawrenson to be said, or did you just hear about it as it was being done?
I knew him. And,
Well, you actually did some work with him as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts.
Oh, from the very first time that I've heard his music, which when I heard Lux Aeterna, which was actually on a program with a piece that Alva Henderson did of mine, a beautiful piece called Winter Requiem. And there was three performances of these two pieces, and I'd never heard any of Lawrenson's music. And hearing Lux Aeterna three times, at the San Jose Cathedral, then at a Jesuit church in San Francisco, I just knew that I was in the presence of greatness. And I wrote him a letter just saying how impressed I was. And we met a little. When I was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, I with the whole Council on the National Arts, gave him the National Medal of Arts. You know,
it's nice to be king. It's nice to be king at the right time, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you can actually recognize someone who deserves recognition.
Yeah, and so when it was a big moment for him. I mean, it was the first oddly enough, a number of years later, I find myself, coming to University of Southern California to be the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture. And they had a kind of evening in my honor where I read poems and a couple mm-hmm. people spoke. And at this thing, they premiered this song, which I, really hadn't known was in the works.
Wow. That must have been a powerful moment for you.
Oh, no, it was. I mean, to a certain degree, when a great composer sets you to music, mm-hmm. you are going to, have a certain, even if, you're going to have a certain kind of immortality on the basis of that. But vanity aside, I am just happy when I encounter another great living artist.
Absolutely.
Because it makes you feel like this human ability to, in a sense, to create beauty, but to evoke beauty has not been lost in our society. And so, as a poet, working with composers is very important to me. Because I think song and poetry are two sides of the same.
Yeah, and I want our listeners to know two things here at this moment, that you yourself received in 2008 the Presidential Citizens Medal from George W. Bush, and among other very, I think, very laudable awards you've received. But you've written two libretti for operas.
Well, I can agree now because I just had a children's opera premiered recently.
Well, tell us about that because that's not on your Wikipedia either.
Late last year, Laurie Lateman.
Yes, I know. You introduced me to Laurie Lateman.
Yeah, and I did an opera called The Three Feathers. It's based on a fairy tale or a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was done in Virginia at Virginia Tech University and Opera Roanoke.
Mm-hmm.
And it's we like to think of it as kind of a contemporary magic flute.
Mm-hmm.
An opera that you can bring kids to, but it's not.
Is there a recording available of that yet?
Well, there is not commercially. We did we have a very good, an extraordinarily good, filming of the performance that we're showing to other opera companies. But it will be recorded.
It'll get around, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, some of the arias are already being done separately.
That's wonderful.
But I think that this is one of the great things.
You're our Hugo von Hofmannsthal.
Well, I would like to be Hugo von Hofmannsthal, the great Austrian poet.
He wrote for Richard Strauss.
Yeah,
yes.
But Hofmannsthal did something else that people forget. He was one of the there's the greatest arts festival probably in the world is the Salzburg Festival, which was founded, by the Catholic Archbishop of Salzburg with Hugo von Hofmannsthal. Richard Strauss was involved in what was the great director, Max Reinhardt.
Yes.
And,
who brought Korngold to Hollywood.
Yes. And, von Hofmannsthal, is this great poet and librettist, had this vision of trying, in a sense, to bring art, to people.
Mm-hmm.
And also, he stopped. The funny thing is that this is a very strange thing. He became famous, even as a teenager, he was a famous poet. But he stopped writing poetry at the end of his 20s because he wanted to work in theater and opera because he liked the communal aspect of those things that brought people together.
Right.
It's a very Catholic vision,
Yes. I think you like that too. Obvious.
I mean, as Catholics, we are not Calvinists. We don't, it's not just about us being alone in a direct conversation, with God, with no intermediaries. As Catholics, we understand that we are all brothers and sisters, that we have communal worship. And, when I go to Mass, I have two parishes because I'm both in Northern and Southern California.
Right.
And I'm sitting with people, and some of whom are strangers, some of whom are not enormously appealing people on the outside. I kneel and I pray and I worship with them, and I understand that we are all one family.
Yes.
And it's that communal nature of Catholicism, which is part of how, in a sense, we receive God's truth. And von Hofmannsthal was very much fascinated by the kind of experiences you can have, not individually, but communally. So as a poet, my work gets around, three ways. One is just people reading it, probably silently, even perhaps on
right.
the page. But also I do a lot of readings where I want them to hear
yes.
the work. I don't think that they actually know my work unless they hear it. And then there's a whole other level, which is when I work with composers who are setting it to music. And so I look on this, these are not, I don't think these are different things. I look at it as a continuity, with the oral performance sort of in the middle. On one side is the enhancements of music, and on the other is the kind of intense individual attention of reading. And you got to do all of those things well, or I think you're not really fulfilling yourself as a poet. I don't want to limit my whole career to writing little things on one piece of paper, I want to try everything that a poet might do.
Well, as you described your attitude toward writing poetry when you were talking about your 99 poems, it almost seems as if when your poem becomes an actual song, it has achieved its fullness.
Yeah, oh, it is. It's a. I mean, I think the poem itself is full, but it's what you have then is you have a you have a way of the song, if it's good, reveals hidden mysteries of the poem. You know, because there'll be things that you know that is. I mean,
it's as if grace has descended upon the poem.
And they'll find things and they'll elicit it. But anyway, I think it's. I mean, it's a funny thing to be a poet in the modern world. Let's be honest about this. I mean, you know, this is not, you know. Mothers and fathers, don't let your kids be.
No, and imagine being a French poet. I mean, you'd be expelled.
It's just very odd. It's a very odd thing. But if you're going to be a poet, you're going to take it seriously. You know, you realize you're in this continuity with the past, with the most ancient path. And it was wonderful when I went into the Luca Signorelli Chapel in the great cathedral of Orvieto, and I walked to see these frescoes about the end of the world, the resurrection of the dead, the last judgment by Signorelli. These were things that Michelangelo saw and used for the Sistine Chapel. The room is decorated with these circular, like painted medallions, and in the middle of each medallion is a great poet.
Yes.
And not just a great Christian poet, is the great poets of Rome. So you have Dante, but you have Virgil, you have Ovid, you have Homer, you have Lucan, and you have Homer, who's a Greek poet. And I think what Signorelli is doing is honoring the poets as the great priests of the imagination. And so, you know, I've been reading a lot of Wordsworth, and Wordsworth, you know, they don't teach him this way, but Wordsworth was this profoundly Christian religious poet.
A revolutionary.
Yeah, he's kind of a prophet.
Yeah.
And this prophet of understanding the beauty of creation. And you know, and I don't go around saying I'm a prophet or anything like this, but I want some aspect of that of that ancient function to be present in my work. That's why
I think it is.
First section is called Mysteries.
Yeah, you don't, Dana, you don't need to say it about yourself because other people say it of you, and that's even better. I want to ask you this question, though. Hypothetically, you're on an airplane, and you start chatting up, or the person next to you starts chatting up. You're having a conversation. You get along great. And then they suddenly say, well, what do? What is that moment like when you say, well, I'm a poet?
Well, you know, the old days, I used to be able to have cover. I used to say I'm a businessman, you know.
Right.
Come up. But I used to say I'm a writer.
Well, the one thing about you, Dana, is that you, I think, destroy pretty effectively the caricature people have of being a poet.
Well, you know, part of that caricature is true. Poets necessarily kind of live in their own heads. I think, you know, real poets emerge all over the world. You know, they aren't all, you know, teachers of creative writing. And, you know, I feel lucky that because of, you know, all the complicated reasons of one's life, that I have, you know, worked in business, I've worked in government, I've worked in journalism, I've worked with musicians, because I think that variety of experience has made me a better poet. And in a funny way, working with ordinary people in the business world, you know, for years and years of my life, it grounded me as a poet. It kept me from being so airy and intellectual, which I have a capacity to be. You know, I mean, I could have been, somebody totally absorbed in my own thoughts, but it brought me, you know, basically into a common sense and truthful relationship with the world around me.
Well, that brings up a question I meant to ask you earlier. You know, George Steiner, the famous critic, in writing about the issue of the Holocaust and the fact that the Nazi officers that were systematically participating in the extermination of millions of Jews and Catholics and so forth, that they were all highly educated in the gymnasium system of Germany. And he says that there's something about, he believes, the study of literature that lends itself to a detachment from reality and therefore makes people not so much humanized as we want to believe in the liberal arts, but subject to being caught up in unreality.
You know, I don't necessarily agree with Steiner. You know, I think part of the problem is that Steiner may be looking at the Nazi Holocaust as a unique human event. But people have been killing each other, you know, for as long as people have been around, you know, and while that was going on, probably less educated people in Russia were running the gulag system. So, you know, I think the point to make is from that is that art alone will not save you. You know, art alone, art develops capacities. I think it educates and it refines us. But if you do as Nazi Germany did, and you take, you know, a vision of society, you know, a vision of human existence away from any sense of the divine, if you make humanity, or if you make, in the Nazi case, one tribe of humanity, the Germans, you know, and the German people, your God, you know, you end up in very bad places. So, you know, I wouldn't blame it on Goethe and Schubert.
Or Bach.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the, you know, and
you or the know, learning of Latin and Greek,
yeah,
for that matter.
You know, the Germans are pretty, unless you're a Greek, I think that, you know, the Germans are pretty well behaved, you know.
The you know, you're now a distinguished chair at the University of Southern California, and you're teaching poetry and public culture. That's the name of your chair. I spent many of my years in the academy and consider, you know, the dominant voice in the academy to be extremely left-wing and to a certain extent out of touch with reality. What's the connection between the life in the academy as you're experiencing it and the life outside?
Well, I mean, the university, you know, whatever one, you know, whatever criticisms one has about it, the university is a wonderful place. You know, it has, you know, it's these powerful institutions that preserve knowledge and teach, become formative experiences, you know, for the students. At the moment, you know, and I think probably at all moments, the university tends to be a place where ideas, you know, are probably put to extremes and practiced rather crudely in a social sense. You know, there's always a homogeneity of opinion. And, you know, and it's true. I mean, the University of Southern California, I think, is probably a more diverse, you know, place than many universities. But and I've resisted teaching for most of my career. You know, it just didn't feel like the place I wanted to be. I wanted to make my living as a writer, so I turned down lots of jobs. What attracted me about the University of Southern California was that they were offering me a job, in a sense, which I could design myself. And so I teach three classes. I teach what may be the largest undergraduate class in the humanities, an introduction to poetry to undergraduates. And I like the fact that I'm teaching this to people who are going to become physicians, engineers, business people, scientists.
Right.
And it's a very, very hard class. I mean, I work these kids to the bone because I want to immerse them in the art in the deepest way. They have to memorize, they have to, you know, read, write about poetry, memorize, they have to attend readings and concerts. The second class I teach is a tiny class, you know, it has perhaps 10, one year it had 40, but usually about 10 people. It's called Words and Music.
Ah, yes, that's one I'd like to take.
Yeah, and my students are all composers, singers, and musicians. And we talk about the relationship between poetry and different kinds of music, opera, art song, you know, choral music.
Dana, we've got about 30 seconds left.
Yep.
What's the third course?
And I like that. The third course is arts leadership.
Ah.
I'm trying to teach young artists, you know, how they can make a, you know, their way through the world, either creating a new organization or running an organization. So it's an unusual professorship.
Dana, I want to just end by thanking you for being on Church and Culture, but also quoting Morton Lorenson, who calls you a national treasure, and I fully agree. Thank you so much for being on Church and Culture once again.
Delighted to be here.
And to all of you who are listening, please hang around. After this message, we're going to have another wonderful guest.
Putting on the Mind of Christ this week, we continue with our talks from the recent Call to Holiness Conference with Jeff Capens and Raymond Arroyo.
They entice you and your children to sit on the floor or on the couch and soak up the daily catechism, the ever-shifting politically correct toxin that lies at the heart of this new magisterium. Who is the new magisterium? Our name is media, and we are many. The media has become its own magisterium. It hands out its own version of the truth. We have penetrated every part of your life, and we've reshaped it.
This is Henry Root, your host and program producer for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Jeff Caban speaks about the Eucharistic sacrifice, and Raymond Arroyo talks about the electronic magisterium on the next Putting on the Mind of Christ. Join us this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO and 1440 WMAX for Putting on the Mind of Christ.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" They reply, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Then Jesus presses them, "Who do you say that I am?" The disciples try to dodge the question, responding with what other people are saying about Jesus. In our world today, does the same, calling Jesus a good teacher or a good man in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some even dismiss him as a myth or a legend. But the Lord is asking us for our answer. Who do you say that I am? Not what academia, entertainment, culture, or politics have to say. You. It is your choice and your Holy Spirit-inspired answer. What do you say?
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Have you ever wondered where the ideas for your favorite movies come from? Hear from our guest, Michael Flaherty, as he speaks with host Mike Ferris about the people that inspired Walden Media's most successful films. That's today on Homeschool Heartbeat.
Michael, the company you helped found nearly 14 years ago in your apartment has now produced over 30 feature films. How do you decide which stories are worthy of being told on the big screen?
Well, the teachers and librarians and pastors, they've been our perfect North Star. And so Hole, Charlotte's Web, Bridge to Terabithia, a lot of these come from teachers, and a lot of them actually came from my wife's fourth grade reading list. She used to be a teacher at St. Peter's in South Boston. So many of those came from there. The films that we've had that haven't done well, they're usually the ones where we all sit down and get so seduced by our own counsel and really think we know what we're doing. And so we've always course corrected and realized we do our best when we're talking to parents and teachers and librarians, pastors, people that know kids the best.
Michael, it's interesting. I started Patrick Henry College in essentially the same fashion. I was just listening to parents and students talk about their needs. And if you listen to people and really take in what they have to say and then try to meet the needs that they express, you really can have success in coming to meet people's needs. And I think God blesses that kind of an approach to business. So I'm really glad that you've made these movies. I especially love Amazing Grace. Thanks so much. I'm Mike Ferris.
Today's program was part of a longer interview. If you'd like to hear the whole